for Insight with Jack Stogler on the Fort Recovery Internet Radio.
Well, we have a little bit of a problem. Our commercials don't want to play. Our introduction doesn't want to play. I thought I had it figured out. We can hear it, but it's not going through over the air, so I'll have to figure out a different way to do it. I can't get it into our playlist. Something's wrong with my computer, so we'll just start in. It's Insight, usually with Jack Stogler. He's off, probably be back next week, and we are here with Aaron Miner. And you are the assistant prosecuting attorney, is that?
That's right, yeah.
Okay.
One of the assistant prosecuting attorneys for Mercer County.
Well, the best one.
Correct. You're starting off on the right foot, Neil.
So, you want to tell us a little bit about yourself, family, education, anything real quick before we go to our little quick commercial?
Sure. So, I'll just tell a little bit about my family first. My husband, Matt, he co-owns the hardware store with Steve Schmitz. Pretty much everybody knows Matt and no one knows me, which is just how I like it. We have two children. Marshall is 5 and Mary's 4. They just started preschool this year at Fort Recovery. A little bit about my educational and educational background and work history. So graduated from Calder High School in 2001. Went to the University of Dayton, got a bachelor's degree in secondary science education. Taught at Centerville High School. I taught high school science there before deciding that while I respect teachers very greatly, it was not something that I wanted to do for the rest of my career. So I started at Wright State working on a master's degree in biology. Ended up transferring down to Tulane in New Orleans, got my master's degree down there, also went to law school at Tulane, ended up living in New Orleans for about 6 years total, worked down there for a law firm before moving up to Northern Kentucky and working for a law firm in Cincinnati for a couple of years. And Matt and I decided that we really just wanted to move home to be closer to family and friends. And Matt really had a strong desire to come back and work at the hardware store with his mom and his dad and Steve. And so we made the move, I believe, in 2014. And I worked for the Village of Fort Recovery for about 3.5 years. It was a great experience working with Randy. Served as their attorney and also grants administrator. So I applied for some grants and was really happy during my tenure. We got a lot of money to help with the park systems here. And also administered those grants. And then I started with the prosecutor's office in 2018. I'll be there 3 years this coming March. So that's just kind of a little bit about my personal and educational and employment background. So just to kind of start off, I think that most people are unfamiliar with our court system here in this county, and that's because most of us don't have any interaction really with law enforcement or the courts other than maybe a speeding ticket, or perhaps we've been misfortunate enough to have an OVI, something like that. So there are three courts in Salina. Salina Municipal Court is the court that most people are familiar with because that's where you go if you got to pay a traffic ticket or you have an OVI, something like that. Judge Kathy Spielman, she presides over that court. And George Moore, he prosecutes those cases. So in Salina Municipal Court, they just deal with traffic offenses and what's known as misdemeanor offenses, which are less serious offenses. We also have Common Pleas Court, and Judge Jeffrey Ingram, he presides over that court. That court is where felonies are prosecuted. Judge Ingram also handles civil matters, I believe, that are $20,000 or more that are in dispute. I don't handle any civil matters. Civil being, for example, if you have, let's say you have, you get in a car accident and you want to sue the person that hit you, that would be a civil lawsuit. I only handle criminal issues. And the other court that we have in Salina is Probate Juvenile Court. Formerly, Mary Pat Zitter was the judge of that court for many years. She recently retired, and now Judge Matt Gilmore presides over that court. So a lot of people are somewhat familiar with the main courthouse in Salina, not so much because of Common Pleas Court for having to deal with a criminal issue, but because there are many other offices that are in the court. For example, you have the treasurer, where people will go to pay their property taxes. If you've ever had to file a deed because you've bought or sold property to somebody else. You go to the tax map and the auditor and the recorder. So there are reasons to go to the courthouse other than just for criminal or civil matters because of those other offices that are there. Just to kind of explain a little bit about who is in our office and what we do. So our office is actually two buildings right beside the courthouse. And the elected prosecutor in our office is Matt Fox. He's been the elected prosecutor for about 20 years. We have three assistant prosecutors. Andy Henders, a lot of people are familiar with because he's been working for the county for, I think, over 40 years now. He's had various roles. He was an assistant prosecutor, and he was prosecutor for a long period of time. He's now back to being an assistant as he kind of makes his way towards the end of his career. He handles juvenile prosecutions. He also serves as he provides legal services to all of the townships. He's their counselor. And then we have Amy Eichert. She's another assistant. She handles all the civil matters for the county. So if the county has contractual issues or maybe there's some HR issues with county employees, foreclosure actions because people aren't paying their taxes, those sorts of things. We also have an investigator in our office. His name is Ronald Wattmeyer. And I describe him as being kind of our intermediary between law enforcement and prosecution. He's a retired cop from the Salina Police Department. And he's just an invaluable asset to our office. If we ever get cases that come in the door where we got a few holes in the case, we need a few follow-up things to be done with investigations, he oftentimes fills those holes for us. And then we also have a victim advocate. Her name is Rhonda Helmer. So unfortunately, a lot of our cases involve victims, whether somebody came into your house and stole something or you're a victim of a sex offense, those sorts of things. She helps to keep victims up to speed on what's going on in cases. And if victims have questions about things, she's kind of our first line of defense. She handles those calls and helps to field as many questions as she can that come in from victims. And then we have Rita Reithman. She's our office manager, and I kind of describe her as somebody who does everything. It's hard to really boil her task down to a bullet point list.
Like most people like that, they run the office. Doesn't matter what the title is or who has the boss on their door.
Yeah,
that person runs the office.
She's a jack of all trades, and she's actually going to be retiring pretty soon, and it's going to be a big loss for us because she's got a wealth of knowledge that she's going to be carrying with her when she walks out the door. But to kind of explain a little bit how the process works,
let's take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll get into that the process of how a case actually comes to end up in court. We'll be back in just a minute.
This is Stacy from Brick Street Tavern, and I want to invite you to stop in for our delicious home-cooked daily lunch specials for only $5.25. Starting at 11 Monday through Friday, Brick Street Tavern features Mystery Meal Monday, Meatloaf Tuesday, Roasted Chicken Wednesday, Tenderloin Basket on Thursdays, and on Friday you can choose from our Soup and Salad Bar or our famous half-pound hand-patty cheeseburger basket. We also offer supper specials on Friday and Saturday evening, including a New York strip steak and all-you-can-eat roasted chicken, both complemented by our large salad bar, choice of potato, and a honey roll. Stop in and see us at Brick Street Tavern and enjoy some great home cooking.
Hello, I'm Kenny Canote from K&L Tractor Sales in Fort Recovery, Ohio. I'm inviting you to come and see the new Endurance line of litter spreaders from Salford BBI at K&L Tractor. These spreaders are available in pull type and truck mount models and are designed to be the toughest, most durable spreader in the market today. The Endurance wide swath litter spreader is designed with the poultry grower in mind. With Salford BBI's rugged design and construction, you can more efficiently spread your materials, saving you time and money. Come see these remarkable spreaders from Salford BBI today at K&L Tractor Sales in Fort Recovery, Ohio.
Need a better job where the benefits are great? A family-friendly company with competitive pay, where people stop and greet me when they see my smiling face. Cooper Farms, it's more than a workplace.
Make your own schedule. We're now offering flexible schedule part-time positions. To apply, visit CooperFarmsJobs.com. Cooper Farms, it's more than a workplace.
Fort Recovery Merchants and the Fort Streetcar Classics Car Club are having their fall cruise in on Saturday afternoon, October 9th, on the Brick Street in downtown Fort Recovery from 4 to 8 p.m. Oldies will be playing all day. There will be a 50-50 drawing, and of course, some of the coolest cars around. Make plans now to head up to the Brick Street for the fall cruise in on Saturday afternoon, October 9th, from 4 to 8 p.m. Don't miss it. The Fort Recovery Firefighters are having their famous all-you-can-eat breakfast on Sunday morning, October 10th, from 8 to noon at the Fire Hall. Sausage, pancakes, and omelets custom-made by your firefighters, all-you-can-eat. All the proceeds will go toward new and updated equipment and building upgrades, and it's a free will donation. Don't miss this great breakfast. Head on down to the Fire Hall on Sunday morning, October 10th, from 8 to noon for the Fort Recovery Firefighters' famous omelet, pancake, and sausage breakfast. We're back on Insight with Aaron Miner, assistant prosecuting attorney, assistant or deputy or
assistant.
Assistant prosecuting attorney for Mercer County. So we got a little bit about your background and your education, and you went to University of Dayton, a lot of people like that.
Yeah, I was a flyer.
I'm thinking you did a couple of other things besides just go to school when you were there.
I did, yeah. I cheered for football and basketball while I was there. And growing up, my family always had a strong allegiance to the Flyers. So I just remember watching basketball games and things like that on TV when I was a kid.
Yep.
And so it was a real pleasure to be able to cheer and to be down on the floor. And so it was some moments I certainly won't ever forget. We never had a team that was really all that great. We made it to the NCAA tournament my junior year. Went to Buffalo and lost in the first round. And I know we were all pissed because Xavier got to go to Florida for their first round that year, of course.
Yep.
We land in Buffalo and the snow's blowing in sideways. And But, you know, it was still a lot of fun and had some good memories.
Yeah. So, and then you went down to Tulane for...
That's right.
For law school.
Yeah, so...
What made you go to Tulane? What brought that on? That's a long way from home.
It is. That's a good question. So I had mentioned that I started out at Wright State working on my master's degree in biology, and it's kind of an interesting story. A lot of people think that when I tell it, it's not true, but... when I was finishing up my first year of teaching at Centerville High School, I had gone to a graduate open house at Wright State. My mom and I did, and we were just looking at the different programs that they offered because I knew I wanted to go back and get my master's degree. I had originally thought that I was going to continue to teach full-time and go to school part-time, but I went to this graduate open house and met a lot of nice people and decided that's where I wanted to go. And they had this basically a raffle that you could enter. So you would write your name on a card and they were going to draw one person out for a free year's tuition towards their master's degree. Well, I filled it out and there's, you know, I don't know, thousands of other cards in this bin that I put it in just for the heck of it. And I ended up getting a call about a month later and my name was drawn.
Wow.
So it was, but the caveat was that they did not want to give the free tuition to somebody that was going to go part-time. They wanted to give it to somebody that was going to be a full-time student. And I was a little disenchanted already with teaching, and I suspected that that was something I didn't want to do for my career. So I decided to resign from my teaching position and went back to school full-time. And while I was in my first year at Wright State, I got connected with one of the other professors there who was going to be my advisor, and we established a relationship, and then he ended up accepting a position down at Tulane and essentially said, well, you can finish up your master's degree here at Wright State, or if you want to, you can come down and transfer to Tulane and spend a year down there with me and continue doing the research that we had talked about. And at that point in my life, I was in my low 20s, I would say. I was around 23, 24. Didn't have a lot of things holding me to the area, and I was just kind of looking for a new challenge, and so I said, well, why not? I didn't even go that down there to check out the university, didn't go down there to check out apartments or anything. I just loaded up a U-Haul, and my parents helped move my stuff down there, and I got down there in July of 2007, which was almost 2 years to the date after Hurricane Katrina. Hurricane Katrina had hit on August 29th, 2005. And one of the things that surprised me so much when I got down there 2 years later was how the city was still so much in disarray. It was shocking because I remember thinking to myself, if something terrible like this had happened up in Mercer County, everybody would have gotten together. You know, they'd have come out there with their bulldozers and their skid loaders and their flatbeds, you name it, and helped one another clean up the mess. And a month or two after, you would have never even noticed that anything had happened. Just like with the tornado that happened recently, you know, it was neighbors helping neighbors. Let's do what we can. And that type of camaraderie, can-do attitude, motivation just didn't really seem to exist down in the city. So it took a long time for the city to rebound. I would say I lived there about 2 years before you could drive around to most parts of town and not see effects of Hurricane Katrina. And I thankfully was living in a very nice part of town because it was right next to Tulane University and one other university in the area. So it was a nice area, and it still took that long of a period of time for the homes and businesses and things like that to bounce back. But it was definitely a culturally shocking experience living down there. Just a very different way of life. People much more laid back. My husband Matt joined me when I was in my second year of law school. He moved down, and we enjoyed our time there. There was always something going on. A lot of festivals. A lot of good places to eat. And warm all year round. So one of our favorite things to do in the wintertime would be to go out of
to call your parents and laugh at them.
Yes. Yeah, to rub it in how nice it was.
Sorry.
But we really enjoyed going for walks in the wintertime, walk down to the coffee shop because, you know, it'd be dark by 5:30 in the evening, but it was 60 degrees outside. So that was really nice. And we ended up getting married in my third year of law school and had family and friends come down. And it was in March, and it was about 85 degrees, and it was snowing back home. So everybody really enjoyed the warm weather. And we kind of laughed because when everybody went home, everybody was all sunburned. And so they had a good burn to bring home with them to cold Ohio. So that's how I ended up in New Orleans. We had a nice time there, but we really missed our family and wanted to get back a little closer so we could spend more time with them. But so with regard, kind of going back to talking a little bit more about what we do in the prosecutor's office and what my role is, so trying to explain kind of how a case gets, how I would describe it, is get off the ground and actually get into the court system. So our cases come from various law enforcement agencies here in the county. Of course, we have our own Fort Recovery Police Department, which handles crimes here in Fort Recovery. Coldwater has their own police department. Salina does. And then the Mercer County Sheriff's Office primarily handle investigation of cases that occur outside of city limits.
So probably most of your cases come from the Sheriff's Department or Salina or kind of...
That's a good question. I would say that I would say about 60% of our cases come from Salina, maybe a little higher percentage than that. Mm-hmm. And most of the rest of our cases come from the sheriff's office. Now, there's a little caveat to that because we primarily handle only felonies. So felonies are your more serious crimes. Misdemeanors are handled in municipal court. They're prosecuted by George Moore. He's actually an employee of the city of Salina. So, you know, Fort Recovery might have several misdemeanors through the course of a month, but I don't see any of those because they're less serious crimes. So those would go over to municipal court. But What drives that large portion of our cases coming from the Salina area is because there's such a drug problem in the city of Salina.
Oh, yeah.
Primarily methamphetamines. Yeah. So, you know, there was a lot of talk a few years ago about heroin being a huge problem, and it was. And some of the driver of the heroin problem was the opiate problem. So people would get addicted to painkillers in connection with surgeries or whatever might have been the case. And then when the doctors would refuse to continue to fill the prescription, they went searching for something else. And a lot of people, unfortunately, went to heroin. Now, that wasn't always the path for heroin addicts. That's a small portion of our heroin addicts. But heroin was a huge problem for a long period of time. And I think perhaps it was due to some awareness, perhaps people getting out there and spreading the word about the problem. Perhaps it was really a pricing issue. It may have been that both a supply and a monetary issue, where there was a lot of heroin for a period of time and you could buy it dirt cheap, and then all of a sudden meth came into the area. And for a long time, you would hear stories about basically people cooking meth, you know, out in rural areas. You'd hear about these manufacturing locations. Well, there's been such an influx of methamphetamines from across the border. Mm-hmm. Comes in from outside of the country. They can make it a lot cheaper, apparently, outside the country than they can here. And once that came in, this cheap methamphetamine came in, it sort of displaced heroin, and then you don't really hear about meth labs around here anymore because it's all just coming across the border.
Mm-hmm.
So meth, there's a big supply, and it's cheap. And so it has displaced the heroin that we were seeing a few years ago.
So is one of them more dangerous than the other, or both of them are terrible?
Yeah, they're both terrible. More people would overdose off of heroin than methamphetamines. You don't really hear about people overdosing off of methamphetamines, except if it's laced with either heroin or a synthetic opiate known as fentanyl.
Yeah.
Fentanyl is significantly more dangerous than heroin is. Significantly more. I mean, you could have just a small amount that fits on the end of your pinky finger, and that could cause you to overdose and die. So what we see sometimes is when people overdose on methamphetamines, it's actually because it's laced with some fentanyl. You know, these people will go out on the street and they'll buy from, you know, any,
yeah,
you know, Jim, Joe, or Bob. They have no idea what they're getting.
Right.
And the guy that's selling it probably doesn't even know what's in
right.
it.
Yeah, because it's I'm sure it's...
It's not like it's highly regulated.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And there's not... You're probably not getting it done by scientists.
No, no. You
people
don't have...
Careful.
You don't have scientists weighing it out and checking what the contents of these clear plastic baggies is. No, you're just... Who knows what you're buying? And a lot of times we see that in police reports where police will ask somebody who's overdosed, well, what did you buy or what's in your pocket? And they'll say, well, I don't know. I think I bought meth, but I don't know. So, so that kind of explains why the bulk, I don't want to say all of our cases come from Salina BD, because we do get a lot of sheriff's office cases too. I would say about 60% comes from Salina PD. A large portion of the rest of our cases come from the sheriff's office. And I forgot to mention, I apologize before, that obviously St. Henry has their own police department. We do not get hardly any cases from St. Henry, Coldwater, or Fort Recovery. And I think primarily it's because those locations don't have the felonies. You know, mm-hmm. they may have some misdemeanors, but those go over to Salina Municipal Court. And I also just want to, give a shout out to the law enforcement in our county. Like I said, I've been working in this position for about 3 years, and I can say genuinely and honestly that we have some of the best law enforcement officers in this area who work hard every day, sometimes who deal with just horrible people in awful conditions, and yet they come to work every day and they give it their all, and they're pleasant to work with, and they do their absolute best to bring us cases that we can prosecute. Which kind of brings me to one of the topics, Neil, that you had suggested is that I talk about is prosecution rate. So I don't have any stats to share with you on that, but what I can tell you is virtually all, I don't want to say all, but virtually all of the cases that come to us are either prosecuted by our office, or if we think, you know, we don't really have a felony here, I think this, you know, a misdemeanor fits this set of circumstances better, then we'll send the case over to George Moore in municipal court to prosecute. There are very few cases that we don't prosecute. Sometimes it's simply because we don't have the evidence and there's really no investigative means available to us to garner the evidence. To give you an example, let's say perhaps we have a victim of a sex offense, and sometimes we have victims that come to us and they say, you know, something terrible happened to me about 10 years ago and I want to report it now. And we have no physical evidence, we have no witnesses, so it's really a he said she said situation, and those cases are very difficult to prove. So sometimes we have to decline prosecution of those, but thankfully it's rare.
That's good. Let's take a little break here. We'll come back and talk some more. There's a whole bunch of stuff to cover.
Yes.
And it's to me, this is extremely interesting. We'll be back in just a minute or two.
Klingtern & Sons Trucking Incorporated is a family-owned and operated business in Burkittsville. They have over 50 years of experience, and they pride themselves on their commitment to punctual transportation and exceptional customer service. They offer local and long-haul transportation. They have dump trucks, stone slingers, flatbeds, vans, and refrigerated trailers. They have great employment opportunities as well. Visit their website at klingternandsons.com or call them at 937-338-5000. Call Klingtern & Sons Trucking for all your transportation needs. It's time to eat, and you don't have time to make supper. Just call Miracle Lanes at 375-4274. Everybody can get what they want, whether it's their great sandwiches, fried goodies, subs, salads, or their awesome pizza. Just call them and they'll get it ready for you, then just drive through and pick it up. And it's time to start thinking about reserving lanes for a holiday get-together or birthday party. And don't forget their awesome pizza wing and salad buffet every Friday at lunch. They open at 3 Monday through Thursday and 11 a.m. on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Be sure to put their number in your phone so you can call them with one touch, 375-4274. Miracle Lanes, great food and lots of fun.
The versatile Kubota B-Series is a do-it-all tractor. Run powerful attachments that can be easily switched out. It features a hydrostatic transmission and is simple to maintain. The Kubota B-Series. It makes the hard work look easy. Talk to your local Kubota dealer today to schedule a demo.
Your local Kubota dealer is Hall Brothers in Fort Recovery, Ohio.
The versatile Kubota B.
The American Legion Ladies Auxiliary Annual Breakfast is coming up on Sunday, October 17th, from 8 in the morning to 12:30 in the afternoon. It's all-you-can-eat whole hog sausage, pancakes, and scrambled eggs, plus great homemade baked goods and more, and your beverages included, coffee, milk, and orange juice. It's only $7 for adults and $4 for children 4 to 8, and kids 3 and under are free. Head out to the Legion on Sunday, October 17th, for some great food. It's the Ladies Auxiliary Breakfast from 8 a.m. to 12:30.
Welcome back to
American
Insight.
Legion Ladies Auxiliary Annual Breakfast.
I don't need that. I'm having trouble with my commercials, so it's giving me problems. So I think we have it sorted out here. Anyway, we're here with Erin Miner, and she's the assistant prosecutor for Mercer County, and we've been talking about, well, we talked a little bit about some of the cases, how a case kind of gets started. What other things do you want to would be of interest to us that we're probably not even smart enough to ask about?
The next thing I would like to talk about is kind of how a case moves from intake, from law enforcement, and proceeds through the court system. So our cases do come from law enforcement. Just to give you an example of sort of a typical case, a case that we see often. So the hypothetical is law enforcement driving around in Salina. They see a car make a traffic violation. Okay, let's say they failed to stop at a stop sign or ran a red light. Law enforcement officer pulls them over, and they see that the driver is somebody that has a history of drug use, and they say, you know what, I think I'm going to go ahead and call a trained drug dog here, and we're going to let the drug dog do some sniffing around to see if they can detect any drugs in this car. So the drug dog arrives on scene, does what we call a free air sniff, which basically walks around the vehicle, and if the dog detects any drugs, they have a certain type of posture or movement that they demonstrate to their handlers, indicating that they smell drugs. And why that's such an important tool is if a dog alerts, and what we call alert and indicate, on a vehicle to the presence of drugs, then it gives us probable cause to search the vehicle. So then we, you know, take the occupants out of the vehicle, and we can go through, and our drug dogs are very good at detecting drugs, and so typically when they alert and indicate on a vehicle, we go through and we search the vehicle, we find drugs. All right, so let's say that happens. So law enforcement, usually if that happens, they'll call us and they say, hey, we just found methamphetamine. Here's the offender. We'll be getting you a report soon. Okay, now there's two ways that a case can get off the ground. We get the report, and we can either do what's called filing a state complaint, which has to happen in Salina Municipal Court. And generally, we file a state complaint in cases where there's some sense of urgency. We've got the person in jail, and we want to continue to hold them in jail. We got to get the case up and running. So we file a state complaint in Salina Municipal Court, and that's how it gets the case running. Sometimes we have a case where, let's say, detectives from the sheriff's office have been investigating a burglary for a number of months, and we find out who it is, but we don't know where that offender is. They haven't been placed under arrest. They're not in our jail. So what we will do is we will wait and present the case to grand jury. So some of you may have served on a grand jury before, but basically what a grand jury is we usually have about 9 or 10 members of the community. They come in, we present all the cases we want them to consider in a day. We usually have a law enforcement officer will testify to the facts of the case, and then we let the grand jurors know what charges we want them to consider against each of our offenders. And then it's the grand jurors' job to listen to all the testimony, consider the charges, and if they find that probable cause exists to charge an offender with the crimes that we have asked them to consider, then what happens is we get the issuance of an indictment, which is kind of just a fancy word for a charging instrument. It's just a document that lays out all the charges that we're going to have against any particular offender. So grand jury is different from if you serve on a petit jury, or what most people think of as being a jury that sits at a trial. Grand jury, your job is simply to determine whether probable cause exists, not beyond a reasonable doubt. And probable cause essentially means more likely than not. Okay, so if we ask you to, we present to you a bunch of facts for a meth possession case. We ask you to consider one count, aggravated possession of drugs for methamphetamine. You're going to, as a grand juror, your job is to decide based on the facts that we have presented to you through a law enforcement witness whether this particular offender, more likely than not, possessed methamphetamine on the date in question. We have a very good track record at grand jury of indicting our offenders on all of the charges that we ask grand jurors to consider. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that when our law enforcement sends us reports, they've done a thorough job. They've provided us with good evidence. They've followed all the procedures properly. And so we have a good case to present to the grand jury. So two ways you can start a case off: state complaint in Salina Municipal Court, or indictment in the Common Pleas Court. And one thing to note is, it's kind of a procedural nuance, but once a case starts by a state complaint in Salina Municipal Court, eventually that case will have to make its way over to Common Pleas Court, and that case will also be presented to a grand jury. But in any event, that's what gets the case started. And then from there, a defendant will get either appointed counsel if they can't afford one, or they will get retained counsel if they can afford to hire their own attorney. I would say greater than 9 out of 10 defendants is probably more like 95-96% of the people that come through our doors cannot afford an attorney. So the court will appoint an attorney, and we have several very competent attorneys within the county that will take appointments. We also have some attorneys from St. Mary's, attorneys that practice out of the Lima and Walpock areas, simply because we have so many cases that our local attorneys here just can't handle them all, because pretty much all of our attorneys in the area don't just exclusively do criminal defense work. They do all kinds of stuff. You know, they handle civil disputes, real estate transactions. They help people with wills and estates.
Yeah,
and
do what most people kind of, most people's relationship with an attorney is.
Exactly.
You know, a lot of people think, well, if I need an attorney, I'm in trouble. But that's not at all true. You're in trouble if you don't have one helping you with a lot of things.
You're right. Most people, your interaction with an attorney happens because you say, you know what, I really need to get a will. I need to protect my assets. So if something happens to me, you know, my kids or my spouse, we want to make sure that everything goes where it needs to go. So our local attorneys are very busy. They have a lot of balls up in the air at any given time. But in any event, so once a defendant gets an attorney, either an appointed attorney or they hire their own attorney, then the case really gets off and running. And so we have several different court appearances. We have an initial appearance where the defendant is officially, the court describes to them their charges, explains that to them. They have an arraignment where they can either plead guilty or not guilty, or no contest. Everybody pleads not guilty, pretty much.
Aren't they kind of advised to do that by both sides?
Well,
so the thing can actually proceed in the actual evidence can be shown, or I'm watching TV too much.
Yes, you are. No, we would never advise a defendant to plead not guilty, but
you've done all this work to get the evidence to convict them.
That's true. But you know, it's just par for the course. You're going to plead not guilty, because if you plead guilty, you have no chance to negotiate, right? So everybody mm-hmm. wants to negotiate, and so. Most of our cases, again, end in some sort of negotiation. I know on TV...
Wondering about that.
You know, you see on TV, on Law & Order, every case goes to trial. It's just... It's not practical. It's not feasible. We are dealing with a volume of cases. There is no way we could try every case. And, you know, in a lot of instances, it simply doesn't make sense. So most of our cases end in what's called a plea. All right. So let me give you an example. Let's say somebody is charged with an F5 level meth possession charge, and they have an F3 level heroin charge. All right. So if we're in the process of negotiating, as I'm thinking about whether I want to reduce, whether I want to maybe get rid of the F5 charge, or maybe my strategy is, you know what, if your guy pleads to both of these charges, I'll agree to let him out on bond, which means I'll agree to release him mm-hmm. from jail in advance of sentencing. So there's a lot of dickering that takes place. My goal is to always get to a reasonable resolution based on not only the facts of the case, but someone's criminal history. Mm-hmm. Those are things that we take into consideration, because our ultimate goal is to protect the public. So it's about how can we achieve that.
Yep. Okay. So let's take another break. We'll come back and talk about some more really good stuff with the prosecutor's office back in just a minute.
Remember that scene in the Indiana Jones movie where the old knight tells him to choose wisely? Hi, I'm Connor Ramel with Fort Recovery Insurance. When it comes to insurance, choose wisely. Now, I'm not an old knight, but I do know insurance. From farms to factories to cars and ATVs, don't just spin the wheel and choose the first one that comes up. Insurance is too important not to have some local advice on what is wisest for you. ForRecoveryInsurance.com, your local agent for Ohio Mutual Insurance Group.
This is the first thing you hear after the power goes out. Silence. But that doesn't last very long. The next thing you hear is complaining, then the inevitable whining. No TV, no power for laptops and tablets. How long do you think their cell phone will last without a recharge? How about your cell phone? Now's the time to call Reasoner Energy and talk about Generac generators. Not only do they operate quietly, a Generac generator from Reasoner will silence complaining and whining. Call 419-678-4858.
Market has the best steak prices in the area, always $2, $3, $4 a pound less than everybody else. They buy in large quantities and pass that savings on to you, and there's no limit on how much you can buy at these great prices. Ribeyes are $9.99 a pound, flat iron steaks are $8.99 a pound, and T-bones and New York strips are only $7.99 a pound. Get some steaks and grill them up while the weather's still nice, and grab a bunch more and put them in the freezer to save for later. Great prices on great steaks at Wayne Street Market, the best meat market around. Here are the sports broadcasts coming up this week on Fort Recovery Radio. Tomorrow, the Lady Indians will travel to Minster for a big MAC match. We'll simulcast WPGW's coverage with Indiana Sports Broadcast Hall of Famer Rob Weaver. On Friday, it'll be football hosting Parkway in our homecoming game, and Fort Recovery Radio's broadcast team will bring you that action live, and you can also watch the game on the NFHS network with Fort Recovery Radio's audio. On Saturday, the ladies will host a very tough Fort Laramie team with a JV match starting at 9 a.m., and will simulcast WPGW's broadcast with the NFHS network. Some big games coming up this week for our Indians teams, so get out to all the games you can. But if you just can't get there in person, you can always listen live right here on Fort Recovery Radio, the home of the Indians. Presale tickets for Friday's home football game with Parkway will be sold tomorrow in the middle school office from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m., then in the high school office from noon to 4 p.m. On Friday, tickets will be sold in the high school office from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. Presale tickets are $7 for both adults and students. All tickets at the gate will be $8.
We're back on Insight. We're here with Aaron Miner, the assistant prosecutor. And so we've been talking about how this goes and that goes. What's next on our list of things we want to talk about?
Well, I'm going to pick up a little bit where I left off. So I was talking about pleas. And my buddy Rocker, who's sitting behind me, had a good question during the break. He said, are there some cases that you just can't plead? And I said, yes, yes, there are. Sometimes you get situations where you have a defendant that I would describe as difficult. They won't take what is a reasonable plea offer, and maybe it's just because they've been through the criminal justice so many times, they think they know better than their attorney, or, you know, they might just have an attitude of, you know, what's going to prison another time for me, so I don't care. I just want to take it to trial just to kind of stick it to everybody involved in the system. So there are cases that are difficult to plead simply because you've got a difficult defendant. Other times, the more common type of case that's difficult to plead is your more serious cases. And that makes sense because your more serious cases means that the defendant is facing a greater number of years in prison. So there's a lot of risk involved.
With the recent one that went on with the skeletal thing, I don't know what you're allowed to talk about with that, but would that be one of those where you're just not going to plead that, or was there some leeway there also because there were two people involved and they're probably each blaming the other one for all of it and they were just happened to be there?
Well, that's a good question. I guess the point I just made is sort of a catch-22 because some of our more serious cases, it's more difficult to come to a resolution because there's so much prison time hanging over a defendant's head. Sometimes it's hard to find some middle ground. But on the flip side, sometimes with the more serious cases, presents an opportunity to get a plea, as you mentioned, Neil. So we have a murder prosecution going on right now, and I can talk about that prosecution to the extent that the information is available in the public record. I can't disclose anything that hasn't been made public, but Jeff Gray has made has done a few press conferences, most recently back at the end of August. But there have been a few press conferences over the years, and the Daily Standard has written a few articles about it. So I can kind of talk generally about the case. So right now we are prosecuting a female named Sarah Buzzard. She's about 30 years old, originally from Marion, Indiana, and that's where she was residing when she was arrested on August 25th, I believe, of this year for murdering Ryan Zimmerman. So Ryan Zimmerman was originally from Corbin, Kentucky. He had come up to Ohio to live with Sarah Buzzard, her husband, Corey Buzzard, and Sarah's significant other, who was a female, kind of went by a few different names, most recently went by Jen. So it was a little bit of a complicated relationship structure. But in any event, Ryan went to Columbus to live with them in an apartment, and he was murdered back in 2015, and of course this is all things that we have come to find out after the fact. His remains were found along 127 near the intersection of 127 and Calder Creek Road in early January of 2016. And it's one of those things where you just kind of feel like God must have played a role in all of this, because his remains, the partial remains, were discovered off of the road by a woman who was walking her dog. And when she first saw them, she didn't know if, well, maybe this is just, you know, bones from a deer or something like that. And so she called the sheriff's office and said, geez, I don't really know, you know, I might be losing my mind here, folks, but you know, my dog came across this bone, and I kind of think it looks like it might be a human bone. You know, I'm probably going crazy. Well, they had a deputy went out there and check, and sure enough, the deputies that arrived on scene said, yeah, I think we got something here. And then that kicked off a lengthier search. They had to break through ice to find additional remains. And so it's just one of those things, you know, if she had just said, oh, I must be crazy, I'm just going to keep walking my dog, Ryan's skeletal remains may have never been found. They may have been, you know, drug away by animals or what have you. So it just, I guess it's a reminder to be vigilant when you see something that doesn't seem right. Call somebody, yeah. Right? Because you're never going to be a bother. You're never going to be a bother to someone. It's better to just be safe than sorry. But so once the remains were uncovered and they were confirmed to be human, then it started a essentially 5-year investigation. First of all, trying to figure out who this individual was.
And the whole process, it's a long story and it's crazy, and I cannot figure out how anybody could ever figure out how to do those things that they did. It's unbelievable.
We have an amazing group of detectives at the sheriff's office. They're extremely hardworking, and there were many points in the investigation of this case where they hit brick roads, and it was, let's sit down, let's strategize, let's try to think what other technological capabilities might exist for us to find this piece of information, or let's think about a different path that we can traverse to try to figure out you know, what happened to this kid. So once they were able to identify Ryan, then it the investigation kind of took off and ultimately led to the arrest of Sarah Buzzard on some initial charges that did not include murder, but they arrested her on some initial charges, interviewed her in Marion, Indiana. Through the course of that interview, she did confess to strangling Ryan in the Columbus apartment, dismembering his body with the assistance of her female significant other, Jen, and then disposing of at least some of his remains in Mercer County. Now, after she had provided that confession to law enforcement then went to the house where Sarah and her significant other, Jen, resided with Sarah's mother. to arrest Jen for her involvement in dismembering the body and cleaning up the scene and things like that. And when they went to arrest her, she pulled a firearm out and shot herself. And so while she was somebody that we are confident was involved in the dismemberment and the cleanup of the crime scene, she is no longer someone that can be prosecuted because she is deceased.
And she can't testify.
No, she cannot. So the status of that case right now is, after we got the confession from Sarah, we filed a new state complaint charging her with murder. Case got started in Salina Municipal Court. Then ultimately we presented the case to a Mercer County grand jury in September. And we beefed up those charges once we were able to kind of sort through some additional evidence that was collected through the course of a short period of time by the sheriff's office, and just take a deeper dive into her confession and put some of the puzzle pieces together. But ultimately, we ended up charging her with 18 counts. So some of those counts are charged in the alternative. For example, we charged her with 2 counts of aggravated murder. It's just 2 different ways to commit aggravated murder under the statute. We charged her with murder. We charged her with 2 different counts of murder, multiple counts of kidnapping, abduction, grand theft of an auto, because it's our position that she stole Ryan's car in connection with the series of events that ultimately led to his homicide. Multiple counts of tampering with evidence, gross abuse of a corpse, which is kind of self-explanatory based on the dismemberment of the body and then the disposal of the body here in Mercer County. So she's facing 18 counts right now. The 2 aggravated murder charges carry with them the potential for the death penalty. Mm-hmm. So they are essentially the most serious charges that exist under Ohio law.
Yeah.
So it's a very serious case, rightfully so, based on mm-hmm. What Sarah did to this young guy. And it's horrific, it's egregious, and we hope to do everything we can to get a serious punishment for her. Mm-hmm. He deserves it, and his family deserves it.
I have a off the track question, but I know they probably came here to dump it in some remote area thinking we'll dump it in some rural area. Those bumpkins will never figure anything out. Where, in fact, I saw this on Facebook once, if they'd have dumped it in a big city, it would already be a 10-year-old cold case and nobody would care and they'd never figure it out. But they came to the wrong place. We have smart people with time, and they will not let it go.
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, when you're going to urban areas like Franklin County or Hamilton County or Montgomery County, Cuyahoga County, I mean,
there's so many things going
they're
on.
They're dealing with, you know,
they have to cherry pick a little bit or they'll never get anything.
Yeah, I mean, I hope I don't misquote the statistic, but I recall my boss saying that when he had reached out to Franklin County and you know, they said, yeah, go ahead with the murder prosecution there. Because, you know, some of the crimes happen in Franklin County, and we have crimes that occurred here in Mercer County. And procedurally, either one of us could have gone ahead and taken the prosecution.
Yes.
But
mm-hmm.
he's like, you know, we have 144 active murder prosecutions right now. You guys have none. So if you want it, go ahead.
Yes, and we want it.
Yeah, and we wanted it, right. Yeah. I mean, the victim was found here, and our detectives had done the bulk of the work. They did have some assistance from law enforcement from other agencies along the way. But, you know, they had lived with this case for 5 years, their blood, mm-hmm. sweat, and tears, and we felt that they deserved to have this case prosecuted here.
Yep. Let's take another quick break, and we'll come back, and Bubba's stealing her purse.
Not going to find anything in it. It's okay.
He'll find nothing, but he'll also find everything. So we'll be back in just a minute.
This has been great. Boers Welding and Steel in Fort Recovery has 35 years of business experience with over 150 years of welding experience. From lawnmowers to semis, bring it to Boers, where Steve can send a mobile rig to you. If it can be welded, Boers Welding and Steel can do it. Need something made and fabricated? It's their specialty. Call Renee today at 419-375-4087. Boers Welding and Steel, 2 miles north of Fort Recovery on State Route 49, or call Steve for a quick quote at 419-375-4087.
Need a better job where the benefits are great, a family-friendly company with competitive pay, where people stop and greet me when they see my smiling face. Cooper Farms, it's more than a workplace.
We're offering $1,000 sign-on bonuses for maintenance and CDL drivers. To apply, visit CooperFarmsJobs.com. Cooper Farms, it's more than a workplace.
This is Chad Guggenbiller with CSG Consulting Finance and Brokerage in Fort Recovery. Has your business experience changed within your operation? Or maybe the place you banked with has seen the cultural change or the loss of a long-trusted officer or advisor? Now more than ever, you need a strategy and a plan of action in how to navigate this new season of business. Let me help with this plan. See me, Chad Guggenbiller, at 419-852-4049. CSG Consulting, your partner in planning.
The Travis Fullenkamp Memorial Benefit is coming up on Friday and Saturday, October 22nd and 23rd at the Wendelene Sports Club. Camping will start on Friday night, and the women's quarter auction will start at 7 o'clock, and of course the bars will be open. On Saturday, there will be food and beverages available and fun for all ages. Face painting, inflatables, and an obstacle course for the youngsters. Kyle Kesters will be playing from 2 to 6. The Ohio State-Indiana game will be on the TVs, and the silent auction will start at 2, and you can check out the live auction items. At 7, they'll draw the winners of the four-wheeler and patio set raffles, and the live auction will start. There are lots of great items available to bid on, including Reds tickets, Ohio State-Purdue tickets, a Yeti cooler, several Milwaukee and Steel power tools, and more. After the auctions, stay for music under the tent, and as Travis would say, have just one more. All proceeds go to benefit Ali's Army and the Sawyer Overman Ninja Park Fund. Put it on your calendar, the Travis Fullenkamp Memorial Benefit, Friday and Saturday, October 22nd and 23rd at Wendelene Sports Club.
We're back on Insight, and we have Assistant Prosecutor Aaron Miner, and we've been talking about processes of the court system and a thousand different things. So we've talked about a number of things. Anything else you want to get into, like interesting cases or how stuff works or whatever you want to tell us about?
Sure, Neil. I think
because we don't know any of this stuff. Everything you're telling us is
clearly
brand new.
No.
Well, that's definitely.
No, I think I'm going to wrap up tonight with just sharing a few sort of nuggets that I've gotten along the way during my tenure with the prosecutor's office. So sometimes I get the question of what are your most difficult cases to prosecute? That's an easy one for me to answer. The hardest ones are the ones that involve kids as victims. And unfortunately, we get a lot of children that are victims of sex offenses.
Oh, in Mercer County.
Yes, I know. And you know, when I say a lot.
Are we allowed to hang people?
I don't think so, but sometimes you wish you
could.
Can
we tie up, can we put them in stocks and let people throw rocks at them?
Sometimes that seems like the only adequate punishment. But, you know, I say a lot. It seems like a lot for a small county like ours.
One's a lot.
And the scary thing is that the cases that make it to our office door, you know, are only a fraction of the cases that actually exist.
Yep.
Because oftentimes we have victims and the perpetrator is a family member or a family friend or a neighbor, you know, somebody that's in their close inner circle.
Is that the general rule? Is that the large percentage is someone they know or someone in the family? Or is,
yes.
Probably not stranger around here. In bigger cities, there might be more stranger. But
yeah, I don't know if we've had any of those cases during my tenure, or I can't recall my boss ever talking about a case like that. And I think it's really just one of access. You know,
yeah.
I mean, who has access to children? It's the people in their in the small circle that kind of make up their lives. It's family members, it's friends, that sort of thing. And you know, it just breaks your heart. Sometimes our victims are so young that they have difficulties articulating what exactly happened to them. You know,
right.
They can make
or even knowing that it's wrong.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, they can kind of point and gesture and generally explain what happened. And they kind of, you can tell they have a sense that something's not right here. I know that something's amiss. But you know, they're so innocent. And what scares me the most about those cases is, one, if we don't do something, if we don't get the offender convicted, will this person go on to offend again? Will he or she create another victim? And secondly, my concern is always for the victim to try to get them what we call plugged into services, plugged into counseling, and that sort of thing. Because kids that experience, that are victims of sex offenses, it is something that, whether they want to believe it, their parents want to believe it or not, it is something that will affect them for the rest of their lives. Mm-hmm. It may not be a continuous impact, something they think about every day when they wake up, but it may come in spurts throughout their life. It may be something that they don't really think about in childhood, but then as they start dating, they notice that something just doesn't seem right. There's, you know, I'm having difficulties establishing meaningful relationships with people of the opposite sex, that sort of thing. And so I try to, when I'm talking with parents or guardians or foster parents of children that have been victims of sex offenses, I try to always encourage them to seek out counseling services and have them realize that this is something that will likely be a part of their life, counseling for the rest of their lives. So one thing I wanted to just kind of talk about, we already talked about the Buzzard case. That has been by far my most interesting case. And interesting is kind of a difficult word to put on it, but it's factually complex. Obviously, it's significant depravity. But it's just the different people that are involved had very complicated lives. And so there's just a lot to be interested about that case. Obviously, with the understanding that horrible thing happened, horrible thing. And we want to bring justice for Ryan Zimmerman and hopefully bring some closure to his family. Most difficult parts of my job, I think one of the things that bothers me so much is when we have a defendant that's in our jail and they want to get out on what's called bond. Mm-hmm. Okay, so many times we'll hold a defendant at least for a period of time on the typical bond is $50,000 subject to 10%, which means if you can come up with $5,000, you can get out. But on our defendants that we don't think they are a threat to themselves or a threat to society, we'll grant them what's called an own recognizance bond, which basically means you don't have to pony up any cash. You can just walk out, but you gotta comply with these conditions, which are things like subject yourself to random drug testing, don't use drugs or alcohol, don't violate any state, federal, or local laws, those sorts of things.
Don't leave such and such area.
Yes, exactly. So for
now,
example,
if Bubba was one of those people, would he be allowed to drive over to Portland and go to El Camino's?
I don't know. I think
just trying to help you out, Bob. Just in case you murder somebody, still go to El Camino's. Anyway, sorry about that.
No, it's okay. So my biggest beef is when we got a female. Typically, it's female. They are in our jail for drug offenses. All right. When they were brought into the jail, they tested positive for you name it: methamphetamines, fentanyl, heroin, THC, the whole rainbow of drugs. And then they get in front of the judge and they say, "You gotta let me out of jail because I gotta get home and take care of my kids." And that always burns me to no end because, first of all, you sure as hell weren't taking care of your kids when you were using meth and fentanyl and smoking pot and all this other stuff. And secondly, a lot of times the offender doesn't even have possession of their kids. Either mom is raising kids or kids are in foster care or whatever. They're just using them as an excuse to get out and a lot of times continue to abuse drugs. And then the third reason why it bothers me so much is that don't use your kids as an excuse to get out of jail. That just, you know, a parent that is a good parent and cares about their kids would never say, you know what, I did wrong, but let me out because of my kids. I just For some reason, that always bothers me more than anything.
So when you get to be a judge and get to decide who gets to bail, it's going to be a little tough?
Yeah, they better not use their kids as an excuse. I'll tell you that. I guess another sort of interesting fact pattern that's crept up a couple of times while I've been working for the prosecutor's office is for some reason guys think it's a really good idea to shove drugs up their anal cavity. And so it always amazes me.
I hope they use a bag because sometimes that'll absorb a lot of stuff.
You wouldn't believe what people can get up there. It's pretty fascinating. I think we even had a guy that stuck syringes up there one time. So I'm sure that was a pleasant experience. But, so people, they're trying to hide, they're in a traffic stop or something, and they know the police are going to find their drugs, and they're trying to hide them any way possible. Or they're getting booked into the jail, and they need their drugs so they don't go through withdrawal symptoms, so they try to stick it up their anal cavity to get it into the jail. So that was a problem for a while, but the jail staff has really done a good job locking things down and keeping drugs from coming into the jail. I think two more things I want to talk about. Favorite part of my job, by far, working with law enforcement here in our county. As I mentioned before, we have the best law enforcement officers, hardworking, kind. They care about what they do. And then I also just want to give a little shout out to our local attorneys here. Also hardworking. They have, they practice in many different areas of the law, not just criminal defense. And I find
these
that
are your opponents you're speaking nicely of.
I know. But you know what? To be able to resolve cases, you got to work with people.
Yeah.
And I think if you ask any of the attorneys in the area, one thing they'll say about me is I'm reasonable. All right. So I understand that if I'm going to get a plea out of somebody, I got to give a little. All right, I'm not going to expect you to plead and not get anything in return because they've got to do a good job for their clients. So it's about finding a middle ground that makes sense.
And if it's some repeat person, you probably don't give anything. And if it's just some regular guy that made a mistake and is probably going to learn their lesson, you can be a lot more lenient.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we use discretion.
As you said, reasonable.
Yeah, we use discretion all of the time. If we got somebody that's been to prison multiple times before and has, serious convictions in his history, I'm arguing for prison every time, which kind of brings up a good point, too. People conflate the two terms, prison and jail, two totally different things. Jail is our local jail here in Mercer County. Mm-hmm. So that's where people sit during the pendency of their case while their case is going on. And also if they're doing some time for a misdemeanor, and occasionally we have for some felony offenses, they'll just sit time in what we call local time, which means out at the jail. If you're going to prison, that means you are now under the care and direction of the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Correction. You're no longer in Mercer County. You're getting shipped. There isn't one particular prison, not just one facility here in the state. There's actually 28 prisons across the state of Ohio.
Wow.
Only one for women and 27 for men. So we have multiple facilities located in multiple areas of the state. But I think a lot of people, they get those two terms mixed up, and they actually mean two entirely different things. One last thing I want to talk about, Neil, is one of your talking points you had mentioned is, have you ever prosecuted anyone you think might be innocent? And the answer to that is emphatically no. If
it happens on TV.
Right.
I saw it last week.
It must be real. What I can tell you is that when we bring a case to the grand jury, we believe at that point that we have a solid case, and whatever we are charging the defendant with, that defendant did. They committed those crimes. Now, if during the pendency of the case, new evidence comes to light and we say, oh, wow, this person didn't do this, which I don't think has actually ever happened during my tenure, of course we would not continue the prosecution. Ethically, we're not allowed to do that. And just morally, I would never do that. Just a very simple example, let's say, of a case. Let's say we indicted somebody for a felony of the third degree drug possession offense because we believed that they had an amount of methamphetamines on them that was F3 level. Okay, but then so we send the drugs off to the lab to be tested and weighed and all that kind of stuff, and we get the drug test back the results back, and lo and behold, it's not F3 level. It's actually only F5 level. We don't have as much as we thought, because when we weighed it here, when it was at the sheriff's office, it was the drugs were inside of a baggie, which were inside of a baggie, and so on and so forth. We didn't want to take the drugs out of the baggie for safety of the officers. So in any event, it ended the actual drugs themselves ended up being less than we thought. Mm-hmm. Well, what are we going to do? We're going to amend that charge down to an F5. We're not going to try to stick them with the F3. That's not how we work. So I appreciate you asking that question, but you know, our goal is not to put innocent people in jail or send innocent people to prison
or spend taxpayers' money prosecuting somebody that isn't.
Our goal is to work with law enforcement and do everything we can to protect the citizens of Mercer County, and it's my intent during my tenure with the prosecutor's office to continue to do that to the best of my abilities.
That's awesome. We really appreciate you coming in and going through things with us on what goes on at the prosecutor's office. This has been fascinating. I thought I had a pretty good idea on stuff, but most of mine came from TV. So,
Neil, when you told me how much I was going to get paid for doing this, I couldn't pass it up.
get peanuts and a cheese tray. And a bottle of water.
Hey, it's all good.
We really appreciate it. Aaron Miner has been our guest on Insight, and I think we still need to get to Rocker here. And he's got a little bit of this day in history. So get on over here and steal a microphone and maybe a headset and tell us what you got going on there, Rocker. Thanks again, Aaron. We really appreciate you coming in. And we can, if you ever have anything that you think we want to know about, you're very, very welcome to stop on back, let us know, and we'll get you on.
Thank you, Neil. It's a pleasure being here.
All righty. Thank you very much. Rocker, so what do you have there for us?
On this day in history.
So this is October 6th.
1882. Boy, we're going way back for this one.
Columbus sailed the ocean blue.
That was a few years ago.
Genius.
That's close enough. It's within a millennium.
First World Series featuring the Red Stockings and the Chicago White Sox. The Reds won that one 4-0.
Red Stockings. That's the Cincinnati Reds?
Yes.
Cincinnati Red Stockings versus who?
The Chicago White Sox.
Chicago White Sox. So red versus white.
The Battle of the Sox.
Yep. Red versus white. Red won that time.
Yes.
So was it a 7-game series? Do we know?
Back then, I think it was more than that, even.
20-game series?
9 or 10.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a long time. Thank God they dial that down.
I'll see if I can find that on YouTube, see if I can see a video of that.
Not likely.
Oh, okay.
1948. Here's a big word for you. Paleontologist Mary Leakey finds partial skull of an ape and human on the Rusinga Island in Kenya.
Well, then.
Apes back.
So apes and humans.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they always say we're related somehow. And
yeah. Yeah, I'm related to an ape.
Here's one that'll trigger you a little bit.
Oh, good. Is it the Kennedy thing so Bill can get mad?
Oh, Bill's not here.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
1951, Stalin claims that he has the Soviet Union's first atomic bomb.
Who claimed that?
Stalin.
Oh, Stalin.
Stalin.
He's a low-key guy.
He had the nation's first atomic bomb, is that what you said? Oh, okay. Because we already had one, 45. Yeah.
Oh, here we go.
Kennedy?
Nope. Oh. 1956. Albert Sabin.
Oh.
Says his oral polio vaccine overtook Jonas Salk.
That was a shot.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. I remember that.
So I'm assuming. Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
Well, I was 6 or 7 at the time, and I remember several people I knew who were my age or approximately that who had polio, and it was awful.
Man.
Yeah, I missed that by quite a few years, actually.
Good for you and everybody else that did.
In film, 1927, the jazz singer premiered starring Al Jolson.
Al Jolson.
No. Was this the one? Yeah. Now, is this...
Hello again. Hello.
Yeah, that was a version of it, and there was a different, another version of it later than that, I believe.
Maybe it's been crazy.
Hairball. Now, the Al Jolson version, is that the one where he did blackface?
Yes. Yep. Yes. And I think that was the first talking, first movie with sound.
Now, that would not fly today, obviously.
No, the sound? Yeah.
No, the sound. People like sound.
No, the blackface part.
No, that wouldn't work well. He would be he'd probably be hanged and they'd take his statue down.
I don't think, does he have a statue?
He has one somewhere.
Oh, I'm sure he does.
Hometown of Hoboken, New Jersey. I made that
Frank.
Part up.
Him and Frank.
Yeah, I made that part up. I'm saying he was
Frank Caliendo.
He was from New York, is my guess, and they don't have a statue of him.
No.
He was Jewish.
And they yet had a statue of Bubba yet.
Yep. Yep. Well, it'd have to be gold.
Gold.
For it to be Bubba. Yeah. I mean, why would you piddle around with just iron or steel or copper? That's stupid.
Nothing but the best.
Nothing but the best.
Bubba, fee, what you guys got for sports talk?
In history? 2018? No, my daughter got married.
Anniversary. Right. Happy anniversary.
Yeah. Happy anniversary.
Happy anniversary. Happy anniversary.
3 years.
And on this date in history, 1947, Nancy Gail Spencer was born, my older sister.
Happy birthday, Nancy Gail.
Happy birthday, Dave.
Yep.
Happy birthday.
So,
that's
anything
all, that's
else?
That's all I got.
You didn't give us much to complain about. We like stuff where we can give you a little grief.
Right. We still got an hour to fill there, genius.
Yeah, okay. Well, we'll just take a little break here and we'll come back with sports talk.
That's terrific.
Back in just a minute.
Perfect. Switch it.
Thank you for staying tuned to Insight with Mr. Jack Stogler, right here on the Ford Recovery Internet Radio. This show was being brought to you in part by those community-minded sponsors you heard during the show. Thank you.